It's September 4th, 2015. The place, the Kent County Courthouse in Kent County, Michigan.
Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, I've been advised that you have reached a verdict. Is that so?
Yes, we have.
Judge Paul J. Denenfeld is at the bench. The jury has just come back inside after announcing that they had reached their verdict. At the defense table is a teenage boy, 14 years old, wearing dark slacks and a blue and white plaid collared shirt. He is seated between two of his attorneys, and he anxiously awaits his fate.
We, the jury, find the defendant, Jamarion Longhorn, guilty of first degree. Guilty of first degree murder.
A first degree murder.
Yes, sir.
All right.
Jamarion Longhorn has just been found guilty of first-degree murder. His victim's family is seated in the gallery, and they tearfully embrace after hearing the verdict. The energy in the courtroom is solemn. No one is overjoyed, no one is angry, just solemn and sad. It's a case where there are truly no winners, a case that really puts the justice system to the test. The legal aftermath of a then 12-year-old senselessly murdering a 9-year-old. Today's episode might start with a guilty verdict, but the fact that Jamarion Longhorn was found guilty isn't really the focal point of this case. Instead, how did we get here? Why did Jamarion murder another child? And what would the justice system do with him afterwards? Well, you're about to find out. This is Jillian, and you are listening to Court Junkie, episode 127. On August 4th, 2014, Jamarion Longhorn, 12 years old at the time, called 911 from a home in Kentwood, Michigan, a town about 15 minutes south of downtown Grand Rapids. He had walked to the home and had asked the homeowner if he could use his phone. Glenn Stacy would later tell reporters that he thought the young boy was going to call his mom, but he was surprised when the boy called 911 instead.
Kent County 911, where's your emergency?
I have the address.
Hello, do you have an emergency?
Can I have a police officer at 5657 Madison?
So it's 5657?
Yes.
Okay. And what's happening there?
I just stabbed someone.
You did?
Yes.
Who was it that you just stabbed?
I don't know. I'm fed up with life.
You what?
I'm fed up with life.
Jamarion told the dispatcher that he had just stabbed someone, that he's fed up with life.
Okay, did you stab yourself?
No. Well, I did take a whole bunch of pills to kill myself.
Okay, what's your name?
Jamarion Longhorn.
What is your first name?
Come get me and lock me up forever.
Okay.
For life.
Okay, did you...
Take me to Jupiter. I don't want to be on this earth anymore. Kill me.
Okay, that person you stabbed, are they there with you?
No.
Where are they?
I don't know. He ran.
He ran off?
Could you hurry up and come and get me?
Yeah, we're on the way, but I'm going to ask you some more questions. Can you spell your first name? I didn't understand it.
Jamarion spells his first and last name for her.
Okay, and you don't know who this person was that just came up by you?
Nope.
Okay, and do you still have the knife?
No.
Okay, what did you stab them with?
A knife.
Okay, where is that?
In the grass.
Okay, so it's out in the grass?
Mm-hmm.
Jamarion becomes impatient and tells her to hurry up.
Hurry up.
Hurry up, why? What are you doing?
The person just came. They're going to try to beat me. So hurry up and come kill me or take me to jail. Do something. Exactly how you do on movies. Give me an electric tray. I don't care how I die. Just in the way.
In the background, someone, a male, can be heard asking Jamarion if he did it.
Did you stab him?
They're going to come and kill me. Yes, I did it. Because I'm fed up with life and I want to die. I'm right here.
Jamarian stood calmly as he waited for police to arrive. When they came, he walked up to them, his arms out in front of him, as though he wanted to be handcuffed. He was transported to Mercy Health St. Mary's campus, where detectives interviewed him with his parents close by. "I stabbed him," he told them. Him was 9-year-old Michael Connor Verkirke, who was transported to the hospital, where he died 40 minutes later. Sergeant Robert Decker with the Kentwood Police Department spoke to reporters who had arrived at the playground where the stabbing occurred. He said, quote, "Initially, it appears as if the two do not know each other or were acquaintances. We're not 100% certain, but at this point, we're still investigating that." Jamarian was arrested and charged with first-degree murder, making him the youngest person to ever be accused of murder in Kent County. But investigators were still left wondering why Jamarian had done what he did. Why did he kill another boy, one he seemingly didn't know? Their answer would come after they made another discovery at the hospital. Jamarian was covered in bruises.
I've been working in our prosecutor's office in Kent County here for almost 25 years. When I started in our office, I did our appellate work. Been working in the juvenile division for almost probably 19 years, and I've been the head of it probably for about 7 years.
Vicki Seidel is the head of the juvenile division at the Kent County Prosecutor's Office in Kent County, Michigan.
Our office is kind of divided up between a criminal division, a juvenile division, and our family support division. Our juvenile division, we now have 7 attorneys in our division that handle all of our abuse and neglect cases. We handle all personal protection order violations. We handle mental incompetency hearings. And we also handle, of course, the delinquency cases, which is, of course, our juvenile cases.
In August 2014, Jamarian's case hit her desk. It wasn't a typical case that she was used to seeing. In the past, she had only had 3 cases in which juveniles had been accused of murder, and never one this young.
I was, I guess, pretty stunned that we had, especially when the facts started coming out about what happened and how it happened, although the why of it is always still a mystery to all of us. And, just thinking where are we at, that this kid planted a knife on a playground and then intentionally stabbed somebody a number of times. So shocked and stunned, I guess, would be my first reactions to it, that this had actually happened and that a very young child was killed.
While at the hospital, a gel plasma sample was taken from Jamarian for testing, and the sample showed that Jamarian did have prescription drugs in his system, as he had told the 911 dispatcher, an antidepressant and a sedative anti-nausea medication. A search warrant was conducted on Jamarian's home, where he lived with his mother, stepfather, and 3 siblings. And what investigators found would later be described by one as unsafe and deplorable living conditions. There were rat droppings throughout the house, no sheets on any of the beds, and only minimal food. The prescription drugs in Jamarian's system were located inside the house, prescribed to his mother, Anita Lawhorn. There was also drug paraphernalia, which tested positive for cocaine in the bathroom. As the investigation continued, police zeroed in on Jamarian's mom and stepdad. They discovered that there was a history of child abuse at the home. That in May 2013, Child Protective Services had opened an investigation into Anita Lawhorn and her husband, Bernard Harold. They noted that they had found marks on Jamarian and that the living conditions were deplorable. They never reported their findings to the police, however, and so nothing came of it. Later, the workers involved in the case would be suspended for neglect of duty. Jamarian had gone to live with his father in New York afterwards, but had just returned within weeks of the stabbing. As a result of their investigation, Jamarian's three siblings, ages 2 to 14, were removed from the home within days of Jamarian's arrest. In October 2014, while Jamarian was awaiting trial at the juvenile detention center, Anita Lawhorn was charged with third and fourth degree child abuse, and months later, with felony welfare fraud. She pleaded not guilty to all charges. Her husband, Bernard Harold, was also charged with abusing Jamarian, but he pled guilty to child abuse.
The abuse that he suffered is, it's a factor that goes into what you may or may not do or some of how you would try to rehabilitate him going forward, because clearly that's not a good way for anybody to start their lives. But I don't always view it, and, you know, people might say I'm kind of mean with what I'm about to say, but I don't always view it as an excuse to do what he did. There are a lot of people. We have, unfortunately, I have hundreds of neglect cases that I handle every year. And the children who are abused just don't turn around and kill a seven-year-old child, commit murder. Was it always a concern? Was it always something that we're trying to make sure he can work through as he's going forward with his treatment program that he is engaged in? But it didn't necessarily play into whether or not he needed to be charged, because the reality is he needed to be charged.
In April 2015, Jamarian was evaluated by two psychologists, one for the state and one for his defense. The state psychologist ruled that he understood the charges and was competent to assist in his defense. She testified in a hearing that he knows the victim's name and knows that he was 9 years old. He understands the roles of the prosecutor, the judge, and the jury. But the psychologist for the defense disagreed, saying that he is incompetent to stand trial due to his age and immaturity. She said although he may know the basics of the court system, he doesn't understand things like trials and the appeal system. The defense also told the judge that Jamarian attempted to die by suicide while in juvenile detention, and that he was having trouble sleeping and was experiencing flashbacks. Both psychologists, however, agreed that Jamarian had major depressive disorder and that he struggled with mood disorders and insomnia. Judge Dudenfeld sided with the prosecution and noted that while Jamarian may not understand the complexes of the legal system, that doesn't make him any different than most Americans. And so in September 2015, Jamarian Lawhorn went to trial. He was being tried as an adult, and the jury would have to decide if he was guilty of first-degree murder or not guilty by reason of insanity. Vicki Seidel said that even though Jamarian was being tried as an adult, they still kept his case in their family division. This would give him the same rights as an adult while giving them more sentencing options if it came to that.
What goes into any consideration when we determine whether or not we are going to try a juvenile in the same manner as an adult but keep him in the family division is the seriousness of the offense, you know, the victim's wishes on certain issues, the any programming history or stuff like that they might have had. Now, of course, he didn't have a lot, of course, but those are factors that go into whether or not we are going to treat somebody like an adult.
Prior to opening statements, Judge Dudenfeld told the jury that they must consider Jamarian's mental state at the time the crime was committed. He told them that the defense will argue that Jamarian is not guilty by reason of insanity, and that mental illness and legal insanity are not the same. Assistant Kent County Prosecutor Kevin Bramble gave the opening statements on behalf of the state. He told the jury that Jamarian had been considering killing someone for over a year, that he had been deliberating taking someone with him and then taking his own life. He said that was in Jamarian's own words.
The definition of legal insanity is actually a very narrow one. You have to find, what the defense has to prove, and it's a little unusual in that the defense, when we get to that part of the case, carries the burden there. But they have to demonstrate that the defendant lacked the substantial capacity to understand the wrongfulness of his conduct, or he couldn't conform his conduct to the requirements of the law. And that as a result of a mental illness, again, he couldn't control his, didn't know the wrongfulness of his conduct, or couldn't conform his conduct to the requirements of the law.
He described Michael Connor Verkerke, who went by Connor, as a very likable kid, a very lovable kid, whose teachers and loved ones enjoyed having around. He said Connor made friends easily, and that on August 4th, 2014, that's what he did. He made friends with the defendant. He said Connor is a completely innocent victim in all this, that he had befriended Jamarian at the park, and that when Connor's back was turned, Jamarian took out a knife and stabbed him repeatedly. He described what happened when Jamarian was apprehended.
He wants them to come and arrest him. And he's upset that they've gone to the victim first. Well, finally, Officer Klein, who is responding to the scene as well, shows up and begins to walk towards the defendant because the defendant matches the description provided by dispatch. And as he's walking up to the defendant says, come here and arrest me. And Officer Klein says, why? And the defendant says, because I just stabbed somebody.
Bramble reiterated that Jamarian had been planning this for a year, that that's what he told first responders, that he wanted to kill someone, be arrested, and then have them kill him. He told the jury that Jamarian went into the kitchen at his home, got out a long knife, hid it, walked to the Verkerke home, walked with the boys to the playground, and then concealed the knife in the sand. He said Jamarian was coherent at the time, that you know this because he spoke coherently on the 911 call and to first responders. He said the facts will show that Jamarian clearly knew that what he was doing was wrong, that he's not legally insane, but a calculated murderer. Jamarian's attorney, Charles Bokalew, told the jury that Connor was a totally innocent victim, but that Jamarian was a victim too, that he had been abused and neglected almost his entire life.
You're going to hear that he was beaten often with an extension cord in his back and his legs, whipped by his stepfather. You're going to hear that he was hit by his mother with a belt. You're going to hear that he tells people, I'm bad. I must be bad. I'm a bad person.
He said Jamarian's abuse was disclosed to people at school and to Child Protective Services, that Jamarian's parents were investigated, and that they even admit that some of the abuse took place. But even though there were investigations, nothing was ever done. Jamarian was sent to live with his father for a year, but then he came back and lived with his mom and stepfather again. Things seemed to be going well for a time, but then a week prior to this incident, the abuse started again, and he was threatened with it every day. He told the jury that Jamarian never got help, even though his parents were encouraged to get him help. He said Jamarian couldn't take it anymore, so he took his mother's pills.
So he takes pills, his mother's pills, psychotropic medication, sitting in the bathroom. And you'll hear testimony that was in his system after this incident. They found the existence of these drugs in his system. And what does he tell these people who investigate? There's a lot of things that Mr. Bramble's right. A lot of things are inconsistent. But one thing that is consistent, I want to kill myself. He tells everybody that. I tried to kill myself. I took these pills. I don't know what I'm going to do.
He said every time Jamarian went to an adult, they failed him.
But he had no choice. This was his only way out. He even tried to kill himself. And that failed.
He told the jury that they would have to determine if Connor was the only victim. Connor Connor's younger brother, Cameron, who was 7 years old in 2014 when his brother was killed, testified about what he saw that day. He said he, his brother Connor, and their friend James were playing outside their house when Jamarian approached and asked if they wanted to play with him. They didn't know Jamarian, but they said yes. After they got to the playground, Jamarian dug up a knife from the sand and started cleaning it off. Cameron told the court that he asked Jamarian if he could take the knife to show his mom. Connor was on a slide when Jamarian stood over him and stabbed him. He said afterwards, he helped his brother home, and Connor told him he loved him. He said Connor also said something else, but he couldn't understand him. Connor and Cameron's parents also testified. They said Connor came to them and introduced Jamarian as his new friend. He asked if he could go to the playground with him, and they said yes. When they came back home, Connor's mom said he was bleeding from his mouth, that the blood was coming out like a river, and that it was everywhere. Connor was pronounced dead at the hospital. Responding paramedics testified about transferring Jamarian to the hospital. One ambulance employee testified that while he was evaluating him, Jamarian commented that he had been planning on doing this for more than a year. Quote, Jamarian said he wanted to stab another child and then be killed himself, and he assumed the justice system would put him in the electric chair. He said Jamarian was calm and said he had taken little pink pills. The lead detective in the case, Amal Hooperkar, testified about the search conducted on Jamarian's home. He said the house was in poor condition, that there were electrical issues, mouse droppings, beer cans, and flies everywhere. After Jamarian was taken into custody, investigators asked him why he had stabbed Connor. Hooperkar said Jamarian said he did it because he is bad and always does stupid things and gets in trouble a lot. He said he thought they would probably kill him for doing something like that. He figured they would inject stuff into his body. Dr. Susan Tremonti testified that Jamarian does suffer from mental illnesses, but that he is not legally insane. She told the court that Jamarian knew that what he was doing was wrong, as evidenced by the fact that he hid the knife, walked past other kids he knew beforehand and didn't stab them, and then he called 911 afterwards. She said Jamarian told her that he considered calling Child Protective Services instead of killing someone, but that last time, they didn't help. Dr. David Start, the medical examiner who performed the autopsy on Connor, testified that Connor was stabbed a total of 6 times, mostly in his back and right side. 2 of the stab wounds punctured his lungs. When it was time for the defense to present their case, they called a pediatric child abuse expert, Dr. Deborah Sims, to the stand to testify about what Jamarian told her about his childhood abuse. She said Jamarian told her that his stepdad would beat him with an extension cord if he didn't do simple things, like wash the dishes or refill the ice tray. He told her that his stepdad treated him like a slave. He also told her that he had anger issues and once took a fake toy knife to school. Dr. Sims testified that Jamarian was the victim of pediatric child abuse. She showed the jury photos of scars that were found on Jamarian's legs. Jamarian's mom, Anita Lawhorn, was granted immunity for her testimony during Jamarian's trial, meaning that anything she testified to could not be used against her at her own trial for child abuse. Anita told the court that she used to discipline Jamarian by hitting him with belts, but that she never left any marks on him. She also said she stopped doing that when he was about 7 years old. She described Jamarian as somewhat of a problem child, saying that he would do things like set fires inside the house and forge his stepdad's name on schoolwork. After Child Protective Services got involved, she said they told her to put Jamarian in counseling, but that he wanted to go to New York to live with his dad, so he did that instead. She admitted that she never sent him to counseling. Jamarian went to live with his dad in 2013, but came back in June 2014. She told the court that on August 4th, the day of the murder, Jamarian was grounded and wasn't supposed to leave or play on his computer. He didn't listen, and when his stepdad called home from work that day and found out that he was on the computer, he was mad. His stepdad told him that he was going to be grounded for another week and that he would deal with him when he got home. Anita said that after Jamarian's stepdad said that to him, Jamarian just said okay, and that was it. She didn't see that it affected him. Bernard Harold, Jamarian's stepdad, admitted to using a belt on Jamarian and said he was the one responsible for the scars in the backs of Jamarian's legs. Dr. Priya Rao, a clinical psychologist who met with Jamarian after his arrest, testified that he suffers from mental illness and depression and that he did not understand that his actions were wrong. According to Dr. Rao, childhood abuse can affect the brain in the long term. She said Jamarian lived in a constant state of fear and had trouble with his problem-solving skills. She told the court that Jamarian told her that he didn't actually mean to kill Connor, that he wanted to hurt himself, but then realized it would hurt too much. She said he wanted to get arrested and then die by the electric chair or by lethal injection. He wanted to die. He wanted to end it all, she said. Both the defense and the prosecution ultimately agreed that Jamarian suffers from a mental illness and that he was abused. Jamarian's attorney, Charles Bokalu, said the abuse is the key factor in the case. Quote, "Frankly, we have a situation that's just a tragedy all around. There isn't a good, optimistic feeling that's come from this case. Everything has been depressing. You've only had to experience it for 4 days. Jamarian has experienced it his whole life." Prosecutor Kevin Bramble, however, said that although Jamarian suffers from mental illness, he wasn't legally insane and that he had planned the killing for months. He told the court that if Jamarian had been 30 years old instead of 12, everyone would be thinking what a cold, calculated, and brutal act it was. And he said it is that. It was cold, calculated, and planned. Quote, "He set out to kill someone, and he did it. Take the emotion out of it." After 4 hours of deliberations, the jury voted to convict Jamarian of first-degree murder. After the verdict, members of Connor's family hugged Anita Lawhorn and told her they hope her son gets the help he needs. Later that month, Anita Lawhorn went to trial for child abuse. One of the detectives who interviewed Jamarian after his arrest testified that Jamarian told her that while his brothers and sisters used to get whippings with a belt, he would get them with an extension cord. Jamarian described to the detective various instances in which his stepfather would beat him. One after he let his sister climb a fence. Another after his stepfather caught him playing with a toy gun. He said his stepfather didn't like them to play with toy guns. But when the detective asked Jamarian about bruises that were currently on him, he refused to talk about those, saying it was none of their business. He said, quote, "I think you're trying to get me to get my mom in trouble and she's innocent. She don't do nothing wrong. She's just trying to be a mom." He then said he was done talking. Abuse of Jamarian wasn't the first time Anita Lawhorn had been accused of abusing her children. Years prior, she had been forced to give up custody of her two daughters she had in New York after one was found with broken bones and the other with cigarette burn marks. At her trial, it came out that she had been diagnosed with bipolar disorder, anxiety, post-traumatic stress disorder, and depression. But Anita's attorneys argued that Bernard Harold, her husband and Jamarian's stepfather, had been the one who really beat Jamarian and left marks. This was something Bernard tearfully admitted to in court, saying that he would just lose it and whoop him. He said that's how he was raised and that he was doing what his dad had done to him. I was always raised that a man raises young men, he said. According to a Child Protective Services investigator, however, Anita did admit to hitting Jamarian with a belt twice. Quote, she stated that she was angry, her anger got a hold of her, and that she used a lot of force. Anita was convicted, and both she and Bernard, who had pleaded guilty earlier, were both sentenced to 1 year in jail and 5 years probation. They were to complete parenting classes and couldn't contact Jamarian unless they got permission. Anita apologized in court.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry to my kids. And I'm sorry for all that they've had to go through. And I want to say I'm sorry to Jamarian. And I wish I could have seen the warning signs. And I want him to know that he will always be my son, and I will always be here for him, no matter what. I want to say I'm sorry to the Verkerms. I feel their pain every day, and I couldn't imagine how they feel losing their child. And I'm sorry. I'm sorry to the court. I never imagined that I would be here, standing here like this. I think over and over and over again, what could I have done different? Is all that happened my fault? And what kind of help that I could have gotten for my son?
At Jamarian's sentencing in November, he too apologized for the stabbing. I'm sorry for all the pain you are going through, he said. I wanted to die because I thought there was no way out. Connor's dad told the judge, every day I relive the horror of holding my dying son in my arms. He said he's a shell of the man he once was. Connor's brother Cameron spoke in court too, saying he misses his older brother and will miss him forever. Judge Paul Denenfeld decided to implement what's known as a blended sentence. Jamarian was ordered to a juvenile detention facility for the next 6 to 8 years. If he doesn't get into any trouble, he could potentially avoid serving an adult sentence and go free.
How the law does work is when you have a conviction, and he does have a conviction for first-degree murder, is the judge has an option at just prior to his 19th birthday, he's entitled to a hearing. And at that hearing, basically, the information will show, should he be continued as a court ward for a period of time? Should he be released? Should he be sent to the Department of Corrections? Should an adult sentence be imposed upon him? So we'll have a hearing at that point. And of course, our office will be asking him to keep him at least for sure until extended to his 21st birthday. We can do that because a specified felony was committed. Michigan law allows us to, under certain crimes, ask a court and gives the court jurisdiction to keep a juvenile until they're 21. Now, they're just prior to their 21st birthday, kind of same type of hearing that would have occurred when just prior to his 19th birthday is scheduled again. And at that point, the judge will hear the evidence. Is he real a bit rehabilitated? Is he a risk to the community? Has he taken advantage of the programming, his counseling? There's probably about 9 or 10 factors that go into it, and they're all set forth by our court rules. And we go through those, and if the judge says, well, I think he's really rehabilitated, he can say, all right, you're done, and discharge him from being a court ward, and he might never serve a moment in the Department of Corrections.
Judge Denenfeld said, I believe in redemption. I'm not willing to give that up on a 13-year-old boy at this point. Good luck, he said to Jamarian, as Jamarian left the courtroom to start serving his time at the Juvenile Detention Center. When talking to reporters afterwards, Connor's parents said they were okay with the judge's ruling. Connor's dad said it's up to Jamarian and how much effort he puts into rehabilitating himself and becoming a better person. Jamarian's first review was that following May in 2016. His probation officer told the court that he has occasional outbursts and suffers from PTSD, but the report was generally positive. It was noted that Jamarian's mom had only visited him once since she was released from jail herself 2 months prior. Judge Denenfeld told Jamarian, "You're not perfect. I'm not either. We need to keep working on your issues." 6 months later, in November 2016, everyone gathered in the courtroom again for Jamarian's second review. His case manager, Melissa Emery, told the court that Jamarian was depressed and was processing the seriousness of what he did. She said he had started harming himself and had even attempted suicide. Quote, "Jamarian has an idea in his mind that because he took a life, he doesn't deserve to live." One of Jamarian's counselors, Steve Wheeler, said Jamarian had become very open about the abuse he suffered. Wheeler told the court that it goes beyond abuse, that in his opinion, what Jamarian went through bordered on torture. Melissa Emery said that when Anita Lawhorn visits her son, he gets noticeably better. But she pointed out that Anita had only visited a total of 4 times, even though she was told that she should be coming at least on a monthly basis. The detention center even offered to drive Anita there and back, but Anita still doesn't show. Emery pointed out that Anita wasn't present at the review either. "Today is yet another disappointment regarding Ms. Lawhorn not being here in support of him," she said. Another counselor said that due to Anita's inconsistency, Jamarian would experience mood swings. Jamarian told the court that he doesn't think his mom should be forced to visit him. He said he talked to her about it, but that she always makes excuses, and he doesn't know if she's being honest about it. In November 2017, another review. Anita wasn't present at that one either, and the court heard that she had not visited since July, and that they had been unable to get in contact with her. But despite that, Jamarian's counselors said he was doing well and was extremely remorseful for having killed Connor. The following year, in November 2018, Jamarian's counselors reported that he was continuing to do well. Jamarian himself said, "I thank God for all the support I got. I'm doing good." Judge Denenfeld seemed pleased with Jamarian's progress, saying that he's impressed every time he sees him, and that he's thrilled to watch how he has progressed. Anita did attend this review, although her visits had remained infrequent. This time, the judge addressed her. Quote, "Your visits seem to make a significant difference to Jamarian. He loves you. He loves his siblings. He would like to see all of you as frequently as possible." He asked her if there was anything they could do to make it easier for her to visit. Anita told him that although she works a lot, she has issues with finances. Judge Denenfeld said that all he could do was to encourage her to visit. Quote, "Jamarian committed an unusual offense for a young man of his age. He's doing tremendously well. I just hate to see any kind of setbacks that could be prevented." 1 year later, the court got another positive report about Jamarian. His counselors said that he continues to do extremely well. And there was a surprise attendee this time in court there to support him. Connor Verkerke's grandmother, who had started visiting Jamarian regularly. After the hearing, Jamarian actually spoke to reporters.
"I had no right to kill Connor. I killed him out of anger that I was feeling. And it's only for me, it's time for me to make it right, to own up to my mistakes and just give back to the community for what I took."
He also addressed Connor's grandmother, Toni Nunemaker, and said, "This was the love I needed.
Honestly, one thing I really struggle with is forgiveness, because I just never understood how Miss Toni could forgive me for what I did. And it's like, I just want to prove to the world that I'm not who they thought I was that day."
Jamarian's most recent hearing was in June 2020. The court heard that he was continuing to do extremely well and that he was even mentoring others entering the facility. And there were two additional supporters in the courtroom this time, a former detention worker who had first admitted him into the juvenile facility, and another woman who had since become an advocate for him. Judge Denenfeld told Jamarian that he is an extraordinary young man. Quote, "Every time I see you, I'm more impressed, and you've matured, you've continued to grow. And I think you've got a terrific life ahead of you." Jamarian's 19th birthday is next year, in 2021. That's when the first big hearing Vicki Seidel was talking about will happen, where she and her office will recommend that he stay in juvenile custody until he's 21. The judge has the authority to go with their recommendation, or he could release him. It sounds like it's likely that Jamarian will remain in juvenile detention until he's 21. And when that hearing rolls around, the burden by preponderance of the evidence falls on the prosecution to show that he's either not rehabilitated and or he poses a risk to the public.
The burden is on our office to show that. It's the rules of evidence don't apply. And we go through the same factors we present, kind of what I just gave you, like an overview. We have to present evidence on all of those factors to the judge. And then the judge makes the decision at that point.
All the reporting I found on Jamarian's recent hearings have shown that he's doing great. I asked Vicki what she thinks about Jamarian's progress.
I attend every hearing as well, so I do keep close tabs on his progress. And he's been doing great. And you're right, all the reports are that he's doing great. And matter of fact, although the judge doesn't have to accept any recommendation I would give on and things, he always asked for ours and our opinion of this.
Vicki then stopped for a minute and told me about another case she had, where a juvenile who was a little older than Jamarian shot and killed his stepfather. He was sent to a juvenile detention facility, and according to his plea agreement, he had to be there until his 21st birthday. She called him a trailblazer for their whole program, and they realized that they had to prep him to ensure that he was ready to rejoin society. And to do that, they couldn't just keep him confined. The same now applies to Jamarian.
We started realizing that you can't just keep him in an institutional placement without having outside contact of some sort. So we actually kind of, as part of our design of it, because he needed to get a driver's license. He needs to know how to order a meal. He needs to know how to actually live outside of an institutional placement. So we've built into it in some ways where he can go off grounds for a period of time. He has a couple of people that are really good mentors for him that he does some stuff with. We agreed that he can work in the kitchen to help learn how to cook and all that kind of stuff, and also take college courses. And go and get your, not necessarily a driver's license, but get a Michigan ID. So built into this is where we're trying to integrate him back into society, if you will, so that if he was released on his 19th birthday or 21st birthday, it's not like, hello, you just let me out and you never gave me any ability to be on my own. That's included in the program we're trying to do for the rehabilitation. And every step of the way when he's been granted off campus, if you will, off site, time and overnights even, he's been doing great, which is what the master plan is on any of this. Is one of the major goals of the juvenile justice system is rehabilitation of the offender.
She said the juvenile who killed his stepfather was discharged on his 21st birthday, about a year and a half ago now, and he's been doing great so far, even acting as a mentor now for Jamarian and showing up in support at his hearings. Vicki has hope that Jamarian will be the same.
Do I have what we all hope in the very end is a success story that showed it worked? Yes. Is it going to work for sure with Jamarian? I hope so. Otherwise, I feel like I would be wasting my life's work if it didn't work.
As for where Jamarian will go upon his release, Vicky said he already has some options.
In this case, it very interestingly enough, he does have some people, some adults, who have took an interest in his case early on, who in some ways have befriended him. And we do have somebody who's willing to take him into their home when he would be released. So, and that's where we even have some overnight visits going on. So he got lucky, I guess. I don't know if lucky is the right word. I'm going to say lucky. Not everybody might have that to fall back on. And if he didn't, it would be more concerning, because, which is kind of what I was getting at before, is you can't just release somebody if they don't have anywhere that they really can go. Jamarian and his mother have an interesting relationship, but that is not where the plan would be that he would go. At least I don't think that's his plan at this point. But he does have two people that are really good for him. And one of them, actually a third person, which is the grandmother of the victim.
And that's all for this episode. So what do you think about this case? Do you agree with the outcome? Do you think Jamarian should be released on his 21st birthday? Let me know your thoughts by joining the conversation on Instagram at Court Junkie, by tweeting me at Court Junkie Pod, or by emailing me at podcast@courtjunkie.com. I also now have a YouTube channel. Last week, I posted a video talking about my experience filming for 2020, and this week I'm posting a video talking a little bit more about the Jeff Deskovic case. I have some other cool videos coming up, including new videos with one of my friends discussing various court cases. So be sure to subscribe at youtube.com/courtjunkie. Thanks again for listening. Until next time.